Again, in re Estate of Maas. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Shane Plotchek, attorney for appellants. The appellants are the two oldest children of decedent Mildred Maas. And this is a case, an appeal from the District Court of Dodge County, which granted summary judgment for appellee Stephen Langmar, the youngest child of Mildred Maas. Initially, my clients, the objectors, challenged the 2005 will of Ms. Maas, when she executed when she was 89 years old, based on the fact she lacked testamentary capacity, based on the fact they felt there was undue influence. We lost summary judgment on all those issues, and we appealed to this court only that issue of undue influence, waiving any further challenge to the testamentary capacity issue. This court, Your Honors, I would say that the valid or the reasonable standard here is preponderance of the evidence, and I have to prove, or at least my clients have to show, some evidence that Ms. Maas was subjected to undue influence, that there was an opportunity by Mr. Langmar, Stephen Langmar, to exercise it, that there was a motive or that he had a tendency to do these things, and then lastly, that the result of the will would be undue influence. And I believe that we proved those elements, or at least submitted some evidence to the district court. And as this court has said, and I believe it was Estate of Bilwak, it's not necessary for me to establish under each of these elements and pigeonhole every element with evidence. That you can consider, or a fact finder can consider, all the evidence as a whole in order to determine if undue influence was prevalent or present. When we look at the 2005 will, I would say that initially the evidence that we submitted was that my clients, the two oldest siblings, were completely unaware of the 2005 will. They became aware of it when it was presented for probate, and then upon the deposition of Stephen Langmar, the primary beneficiary of the 2005 will, it was evident that he had come into possession of this will by going to Ms. Maas' house at some point in time, collecting the will as well as some other personal items, and holding on to these items until she passed away, at which point he consulted an attorney, Mr. Gallant, and they filed for formal probate. At the point in time in 2005, Mr. Langmar resided closest in proximity to his mother. In fact, he moved back to the home place where she lived in 91, and she granted him the 40 acres around the house, and then she moved to town. My clients lived in Fremont and Cedar Bluffs, or Ames and Cedar Bluffs, relatively close, but not as close as Stephen. They maintained almost daily phone contact with their mother, so they were aware of her desires. They discussed things. They were unaware of how she treated them in this will. In fact, they had testified in their affidavits and depositions that over the course of their relationship, their mother has always represented that she wanted to treat them fairly and equally. And so some of the evidence presented to the district court was a 1974 will they were aware of, executed by an independent attorney that basically said that this agricultural land could be appraised and Stephen would have a right to buy it at fair market value.
And then there was another will, a second will after that.
There was. I did read an appellee's brief, and I am aware of a 1991 will. I had never seen an executed copy of it. I did Mr. Gallant's deposition, and at least from my review of that, it's unclear of exactly what the result was. There were some notes written on that 91 will. It looked like some changes were suggested or wanted by Ms. Maas, but again, I've never seen a signed copy of it. It was clear, Chief Judge Moore, that Mr. Gallant had done work for Mr. Langmar and for Ms. Maas, and I think that factual dispute is disputed between appellee and my clients. To what extent was Mr. Gallant representing Mr. Langmar, and to what extent was he representing Ms. Maas? Clearly, he had done some incorporation work for Stephen. From the deposition, it was clear he said, I may have fielded some other phone calls from him. When Ms. Maas passed away, Stephen took that will to Jim Gallant. As we know, the attorney represents a personal representative. Sometimes there can be confusion about whether or not you take the will to whoever executed it or drafted it. But when we look at Ms. Maas in 2005, she was 89 years old, about 2 years removed from cancer, chemotherapy, radiation. My clients testified that she had lost vitality at that point in time. Mr. Langmar was a power of attorney in 2004, given it was healthcare power of attorney, but in reviewing this court's case law on the issue, it doesn't look like to me that it has to be a financial power of attorney, just somebody placed in a position of power, confidence, and control. In looking at things that happened after 2005, and I know that appellee would say, listen, you got to focus on 2005, and I understand that. But my clients attempted to challenge Stevens' position of power in 2011 and try and insert themselves into this power of attorney situation. I arranged for a meeting at an attorney's office, Jim Gallant's office, in 2011. And that situation resulted in a confrontation, and Mr. Langmuir did not want to give up any access or control over Ms. Maz's finances. Additionally, we look at, in the past, was there any situations where Stephen exerted undue influence on his mother? My clients would say in 91 he was gifted 40 acres. And my clients would say over the course of time he had represented before 05, during 05, and after 05, that I can use my reverse psychology on my mother. My argument to the district court is that we're talking about intent of a party, of Mr. Langmuir, and that I don't think summary judgment lends itself to being granted in a situation where mental intent needs to be examined. I think that's more appropriate for a fact finder. When we talk about was the result of this 2005 will the result of undue influence, I obviously point to the result of these specific devices. We look at an estate with probably somewhere around $1.4 million. The two oldest siblings received $100,000 each. Mr. Langmuir received the balance. During his deposition, I know I questioned him about accessing that will in 2010, and he indicated that he didn't feel that the will treated him fairly. And that was because the house was to go to my clients that he estimated was worth about $80,000. My argument to the court was that this would be a signification or a significance because Mr. Langmuir feels wronged in this case, that he feels entitled to everything, and that somebody who has that opinion is likely to say that the ends justify the means. And my client, Ms. Vaca, testified she actually walked in on her mother doing a will with Mr. Gallant. And when Mr. Gallant left prior to execution of the will, her mother confided in her that it was a will transferring everything to Stephen Langmuir. There are no smoking guns in this case, and it's difficult because my clients were not aware of the 2005 will. They weren't aware, as Mr. Langmuir was, that she had changed things. So it's difficult to, after the fact, nine years later, go back and try and recreate, or not recreate, but try and create a record. And so I think this court in Re Estate of Morrell, which I believe Chief Judge Moore and Judge Reedman, you were on as well, you identified some suspicious circumstances, that if somebody's in a position of power and there are suspicious circumstances, that you have to look at this a little bit closer. And our argument all along was that when you consider that Mr. Langmuir received gifts in the past, when you consider the fact that he was power of attorney prior to the will, when you consider the fact that he had this will in his own possession exclusively, unbeknownst to his brother and sister, and then he presented the will for probate with the same attorney that was his mother's attorney, among some other things that were in the record, that we have to look at this relationship closer, and that I think it should have went to a fact finder to determine whether or not undue influence was exerted. And if there aren't any other questions, I'd like to reserve the remaining amount for rebuttal.
That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Please court, Clarence Mock on behalf of Steve Langemeyer, the nominated personal representative of the last will and testament of Mildred Maz, his mother. You should affirm the district court's decision in this case granting summary judgment in favor of Steve Langemeyer related to the claim of undue influence, because the district court was correct in finding that there was virtually an avalanche of contradictory facts belying the claims of Ruth and Robert related to all aspects of the claim of undue influence. But more importantly, as it relates to the pivotal moment in time that this court and the district court should consider, the time of the execution of the will, there was virtually nothing other than belief-based assertions, surmise, conjecture about whether or not Steve Langmuir even attempted to exercise any undue influence, let alone that he substituted his will for his purpose over his mother. Mildred Maz, as they say in the Scribner area, was pretty spry for being 89 years old. They don't make them like Mildred very often. She was an energetic, vigorous, independent woman who lived in her own home, cleaned her own house and maintained it, mowed her own lawn, pumped her own gas. She maintained bank accounts in different cities where she had, which she would travel to because she possessed a driver's license at 89 and drove regularly. She had an active social life within her church, within the community, and with Ruth and Robert, as well as her son Stephen. She was known by her tax preparer as someone who kept meticulous records, who was always prepared there on time, understood things. She bought her own insurance, paid her own taxes. She was the type of person that really, as her daughter said, had a mind of her own and was very capable at all times. In fact, the medical record, which is uncontradicted by her longtime physician, Dr. Sears, said that even though she suffered from diabetes and had a bout with colorectal cancer during 2003, in June of 2005, not only was she doing quite well, except for a little gas, according to him, she was very capable of keeping her own records related to her diabetic condition in measuring the blood sugar, but she was also capable, and he trusted her to make her own decisions about whether or not she wanted to have surgery related to the cancer condition, which she declined, and he said, you know what, that was a good decision that she made. This was a woman who kept to her own self, her affairs in some respects, shared in others. But she ran her own affairs. Jim Gallant, who knew her since 1985 when she was the personal representative of her mother's estate, said she was a good businesswoman. She had a mind of her own. She knew what she wanted. In June of 2005, there just wasn't anything to indicate that she wasn't a person who was significantly physically and mentally capable of making her own decisions. And in June of 2005, it wasn't Steve Langemeyer that made the arrangements to get to change her will. It wasn't Steve Langemeyer that went to the office and consulted with Jim Gallant, who was her attorney since 1985 at least, probably before. It wasn't him that transported her there. It wasn't him that sat in on any conversations. There's no evidence he ever had any conversations with Jim Gallant related to the will. All of that was done by Mildred Maas, because Mildred Maas knew what she wanted, went in and did the made the arrangements for the will and executed it. And by the way, the uncontradicted evidence is that when she came into Gallant's office in June of 2005, before paying for the will herself, that she was totally normal. Not suffering from any kind of diabetic problems where she was hallucinating or any kind of things that they said had happened at some points, although it's really vague as to when and in what relationship it would be to June, that she was acting totally normal, was totally mentally capable, knew what she was doing, she understood what her property was, she had thought this through. This will...
Mr. Monk, if I could interrupt, Mr. Plotzik made some comment this morning about one of the other children walking in during this will execution and her saying she's giving everything to Stephen. Do you know what that is in reference to?
I think that's
to?
Not a correct characterization of the record, and I don't know anything about that. There was never any testimony to that effect. There was a... Gallant went to the...
I might have missed
Gallant, it. I think Gallant went to the... See, a lot of their evidence is not in 2005. It's in 2010 and 2011. So it's way outside what the Heinemann case would say is even material. But be that as it may, what he's talking about, and I think what you'll find in the record, is that Gallant at some point went to talk to his client, Mildred Maas, at a nursing home about possibly changing the power of attorney, something of that nature. Gallant was unclear, he couldn't even remember even doing it, but Ruth Vaca said that she had walked in on Gallant at some point and then claimed that her mother made those statements. But this is in 2010, or 2000, I believe, 5 years after the execution of the will. And you know from looking at the case law in the Heinemann decision, which was 2 years outside of it, that you have to pinpoint the evidence at the time of the will. And even any evidence of undue influence outside that time period, even if proven beyond a reasonable doubt, is simply not material. And so that's the problem that the district court identified when the district court carefully went through the evidence to parse it out, to look at it not only individually but totally, to see whether or not at the pivotal point in this case there was anything that indicated there was undue influence. Mildred Maas had a health care power of attorney, or excuse me, a living will in which Stephen was the power of attorney in fact within the context of that document. There was never any power of attorney, general power of attorney, that granted Stephen control for any faction of Mildred Maas's financial affairs. In fact, just the opposite. She wrote her own checks. She marketed her own grain. She wouldn't even follow Stephen's advice when it came to buying crop insurance. Stephen suggested to her that, you know what, maybe you might want to buy some crop insurance, Mom, since they had a half and half crop share arrangement. She didn't trust insurance companies. And Mildred Maas was an independent person. She said, I'm not going to buy any insurance. Well, guess what happened, as Stephen testified to. He collected because he bought the insurance. She lost her share of the crop that year because she didn't. But that, it just illustrates that she was an independent thinker and certainly not subject to undue influence. I mean, there was no vigorous campaign in this case to isolate her and keep her closeted from Ruth and Robert. They admit that they saw her on a regular basis. For instance, I mean, she wrote them out checks every December and had written them checks in December before the June 2005 will. Gallant was more her attorney than he was Stevens. Gallant couldn't remember. He actually, I did his incorporation at some point. I can't even remember. I made some phone calls. But if you look in the record, Mildred's using Gallant for virtually everything. She was her personal representative in her mother's will, where Gallant was the attorney. He drafted the 1991 will that they can't find. She went to him for the 2005 will. And in each occasion in 1991 and in 2005, Gallant just didn't say, okay, Mildred, that's what you want, fine with me. He actually vetted. Why do you want to do this? And then she explained it. And her explanation is corroborated by notes in the record that were found later on, that she, in her own handwriting, had written as to why she was doing what she was doing. She wanted the farm to remain in the Langmeier name. But more than that, her son Stephen, unlike Ruth and Robert, it's not their fault or anything, it's just the way it happened, Stephen was the one that stayed on the farm.
What do we make of his comment, though, that with his reverse psychology, he could convince his mom to do anything?
Well, I don't think you make any more of it than I hope that my reasoned argument here will persuade you to affirm the district court. Influence is not undue influence. And the fact that he may have been able to use, quote, reverse psychology is not saying anything more than I'll reason with her about it, and I can reason with her. But that's something far different and doesn't rise to the level of substituting his will for his purpose over his mother. It doesn't even come close to that. And so I don't even think there's an established fact on which a sound basis can be formed in which you can even get an inference under the case law. And so I would ask you that you would affirm the district court. I think it was the correct decision. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time does appellant have remaining?
When I address Mr. Mock's statements, what I would say, Your Honors, is that when we looked at Jim Gallant's deposition, he was not clear who called the office. I think initially he said it was Ms. Maas. And when I clarified, Mr. Gallant, do you answer the phones at your office? He said no. So I think there are some disputed facts here. Certainly Ms. Maas, Jim Gallant established, signed that will. Was not a self-proving will. My clients are willing to recognize it's our burden to prove beyond, a preponderance of the evidence, that she lacked testamentary capacity. I don't think they're willing to submit she was competent, but we don't have the evidence, medical or otherwise, in order to show she was not competent to sign that will. So we want to move forward on the undue influence challenge. And I think when you look at the suspicious circumstances behind Mr. Langmeier, and I would say it as a campaign, 91, he got 40 acres. 05, this new will shows up. It happens to be the same attorney Mr. Langmeier uses. 05, the will transfers 80 outright to him, 40 to his sister that he can buy for 20% of the fair market value, 40 acres to his other brother that he can purchase for 20% of fair market value. At that point in time, he was a power of attorney. I know it was healthcare power of attorney, but when you're facing mortality with cancer, radiation, chemotherapy, you could argue that's more significant than perhaps financial power of attorney. He was later granted the financial power of attorney. And I understand these things, like the financial power of attorney, occurred after the fact of the 05 signature. However, I think it gives us a glimpse, a window into what exactly the motivation of Mr. Langmeier was, and that was to control Ms. Maz's finances. So I'd ask that you remand this down and have a fact finder look at the evidence in order to determine if we do meet the standard. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. You are excused and your case is submitted. Next case this morning is McDaniel versus Western Sugar.